abuse on Earth by international treaty. That was part and parcel of the events that led directly to the Block War, with later-era terrorist acts having been managed via the power of readily available military drones that had made it to the open market. After decades of successful drone use, the old American forces found themselves on the wrong side of small, armed Chinese and Indian drones that had been sold to various countries and then eventually found their way into private hands. They were the very devil itself to spot, let alone kill, and could pack enough of a punch to take out a ship or building on the small side, with some carrying between 2 and 4 seeking missiles in addition to their inherent kamikaze capacity. Getting that market under control had become a major factor in having drone use outlawed for international conflicts under a set of treaties signed in Geneva and Copenhagen. That didn't mean that armed drones didn't exist, of course. The Odysseus, and previously the Odyssey, carried carnivore drones, which were quite well armed, but they certainly didn't pack enough of a punch to take on an Imperial cruiser. "Well, they don't need an atmosphere," Steph said. "So we could pack a transition cannon on a drone, and maybe a few charges for it to fire? In a vacuum, it shouldn't matter if containment fails, unless I'm missing something." "Huh." Eric sat back, thinking. "That might work. I'll talk with engineering about it, and maybe they can work something out. Not likely to be enough, but I'll take anything I can get right about now." Steph nodded, knowing that Eric wasn't there for answers. Not really. He'd take them if he could get them, but no, the reason he was there was because he needed to blow off steam before he could go back out and spit in the face of the inevitable. He didn't get that way often, but on occasion the pressure was too much, even for Ray's. "The E is being deployed to my command," Eric said after a moment of silence. "Well, we could use the reinforcements," Steph offered. "Yeah, I know we need them, but they're not equipped for this. Rays, they're Black Navy, same as we are. They want to be out here. They need to be where they can do the most good. You remember that, right?" Steph asked, leaning forward off the edge of his bed. "That need?" "Yeah, I remember." Steph took a breath. "Then remember this, too. Our biggest worry back in the day was not that we might die. We worried far more that we might die for some useless reason because the brass couldn't get their heads out of their asses and spend our lives properly. You're the brass out here, Rays. I know it, everybody on board knows it. And now you'll show the crew of the Big E why the rest of us don't worry about that anymore." He paused. "Spend our lives properly, Rays, and in exchange, we'll ride with you to hell and back." Eric smiled wanly. "Not sure we're coming back." "Then we'll take that fucking place over and retire there." Rankiel. Tanner walked along the path at the top of the massive pyramid that was home for over 1 billion people, 3 other similar structures catching the setting sun in the distance as he looked on at the panoply of color and beauty on display. The deep black of the Primine construction material absorbed energy from the sun, powering much of the inner structures and sending energy on to those who lived in the city that existed all around him. That made the angled obsidian shapes of the buildings contrast against the color of nature beyond in a way that mirrored the conflict that existed in his mind. When he had first learned the nature of Central, Tanner had felt betrayed. He had lived on and served the world of Rankiel his entire life, periods away on patrols notwithstanding. To him, Central had been a servant, an unthinking machine, created by ancestors at some time in the past. He had spent many hours in the facility they had assumed was the core of the Central Archive, requesting historical details, blueprints, even permission to acquire new land grants. That no one could find records of its construction or specifications, well, that was merely appropriate security. The fact that a newcomer to the world, hero or not, was exposed to the truth so quickly upon arrival had left a sharp stabbing sensation deep in Tanner's chest. Eric Weston was his friend, but for those few instants, Tanner almost believed that he hated the man. The feeling passed, of course. Blaming Eric for the actions of Central would be like blaming him for the actions of the Drossen. He had nothing to do with either, other than being present at the right time to make a difference. That he kept it a secret, apparently even from his own people, was somewhat different, but Tanner could understand the reasoning. Certainly he doubted that he would have believed such a story, and he had to admit, even when presented with the truth, Tanner had no clue what he could do with it. So for now, the world had changed, but in such a way that he could not truly find a way to take advantage of. Change seemed the only constant left in Rael Tanner's life and the lives of the Primine people. Sheltered by those who serve, Rael thought as he looked out over the megacity, and those who died. So few here have any idea just how much the universe has changed in the last few years. Of course, that wasn't really fair. The universe hadn't changed. It had just decided in its infinite wisdom that the time had come for the Primine people to see its true nature, or a facet of that nature. The universe was not the quiet home they all believed. It was a roiling, uncaring expanse that contained more horror for those who lived in it than it did comfort. Some of that horror was beautiful, but it was all lethal. Rael despaired that his culture, his people, could continue to exist as they had for millennia in the revelation of such reality. The entity known as central to the people of the Primine found itself considering the implications of change, its thoughts echoing those of the small-statured man who commanded the defense forces for the world and colonies. The universe was a large place, so massive in nature that even a being as long-lived and deeply enculturated in the depths of infinite variance as Central was, only had a passing concept of just how vast it might be. Frame of reference and context defined how one saw the universe, and Central was honest enough to know that his frame of reference was, in some ways, more limited than that of a passing human like Eric Weston, who could directly experience multiple worlds and cultures. The Empire was a concern, though less of one than most of the local humans might believe. What worried Central was deeper than that. It was the force behind the actions of the Empire. Something about the actions associated with this Empire did not ring true to his experience, which ran back farther than most would believe. A guiding force was at play, or so it seemed to Central, a force that was making the Empire choose paths of action less than optimal. The Drossen were a foolish path of action to take by any measure. Certainly a particularly stupid decision there might be ascribed to human insanity, but there had been more inscrutable decisions that made little sense. Central saw a pattern of action influenced by factors beyond his current understanding. That concerned him more than the Empire itself. Factors that could not be identified were factors that might hold supremely nasty surprises for himself and the Primine. Chapter 11. AEV Bellerophon, Deep Space. Captain Roberts settled into the command station of the Bell, checking the reports from the previous watch as a matter of routine. A priority transmit intercepted from the Rogues caught his eye, flagged red as it was. He opened it up, and his deep brown skin turned ashen as he read the contents. I wonder if this is what Custer felt like. Read the report, sir. You've seen it, Commander? Roberts asked Lieutenant Commander Little as the man walked softly over to his station. Yes, sir, I decoded it. Roberts twisted his lips up. Anyone else? No, sir. Your eyes and mine. No one else. Well, I suppose it wouldn't matter much if someone had, Robert said, considering the information and how he was going to disseminate it. Everyone is going to find out soon enough. Little hesitated, but finally nodded. Yes, sir. This report puts them about a week out at their current speed, Roberts noted. Not a lot of time. No, sir. It left him with a significant problem, as his orders were to buy time. He wasn't sure what he could do that might accomplish that mission, however, not with two heroics and a handful of rogues. Honestly, even with every heroic and rogue in the current fleet, the time he could realistically buy would likely be measured in hours, not days. Earthcom will likely be sending updated orders in the meantime, he said. But for now, we'll proceed as planned, adjusting to... He shifted his station, bringing up a stellar map of the region as he considered the local stars and finally pointed to one. "We'll meet them there," Roberts decided. Little leaned over to examine the map briefly, noting the Primonade colony called Marta. "Why there?" "It's the farthest Primonade colony still active. Given the Imperial's current course, I'm guessing that's their beachhead. I don't know what we can do, but if nothing else, we'll be able to observe their protocol for entering a potentially hostile system." "I'll load the nav data," Little said. "We can be there, well, almost 6 days and 12 hours ahead of them." "Time enough to lay a trap, if we can figure one out, I suppose," Robert said. "I want coordinates to transition to the new target system within the hour."
"You've got it, Captain."
Roberts activated the general quarters alarm. "All hands, we will be transitioning within the hour. Secure all stations and stand to general quarters, that is all." Lord's own dreadnought, Empress Leon, deep space. Yaesan Meesh looked over the relay reports, most of them fed from the long-range scouts that were moving on ahead of the main force, some from the Imperial capital and other key planets of the Empire. All things appeared to be proceeding as expected, but of course they had yet to actually encounter the enemy. That would be where the wave met the hull, he expected. There were already some reports filtering in that were concerning, not worrying, and he would deny any who even suggested as much. But scanner ghosts were being reported more often than he would consider normal. Whether that was because there was something out there shadowing them, or because the scanner technicians were seeing things due to the warning that someone might be out there shadowing them, well, in either case, he didn't believe it mattered. "Let them watch if they're there. We are an Imperial fleet and we will do our duty. The more eyes that witness it, the better." This sector was beginning to become known to the Empire's civilian population as one that had successfully resisted multiple Imperial excursions, and that could not be allowed. Revolutions were normal and controlled. The people could not be permitted to believe that they might be able to have a successful revolution. That way lay chaos, and order was the cornerstone of Empire. Yaesan looked out on the endless black of the expanse between stars, wondering what there was out there that the Empire had yet to uncover. What horrors and wonders remained, now that the Drossen had been exposed as reality instead of nightmare fantasy, and the Others and their heretical adherence to the literal interpretation of ancient scripture had been shown to exist. The times were becoming truly fascinating, and Yaesan believed blessed to be living in such a period in the history of the Empire. There were great things to accomplish, tasks to complete, and enemies to vanquish. A lord of battle could ask for little more. He was tired of putting down staged revolts to keep the populace in their place, tired of executing fools and peons who didn't have a chance of fighting back. The Empire needed a true enemy, in his opinion, a force that could stand up and be a real threat, a force that could be paraded in front of the populace and used as an example of why they should continue to work and sacrifice for the good of the Empire. Fear was functional, but Meesh wanted more from his people. He wanted eager sacrifice. The Lord in him sighed, saddened, though, as he was well aware that he would not find that great opposition yet. Even if their intelligence was badly off, there was just no possible way that the Others and their odd allies would have any chance against even a single Imperial fleet, let alone the rest of the power that could be brought by the Empress's own home fleet. It was almost a pity. Still, it was a thought. "If such an enemy does not exist yet, perhaps we might create them." A good thought, Yaesan felt, and one he would seriously consider bringing to the Imperial court in the near future. Perhaps the Drossen themselves. They hold some power in the imagination of the fools who form the lower castes. Stage an attack on a rebellious world, Yaesan supposed idly as his crew worked around him. Leave a few million dead. We could even blame it on the Others. The irony in that is rather delicious, actually. Meesh smiled, amused by the poetry of his musings. AEV Autolycus, Deep Space. With the passing of the Imperial fleet, Morgan and crew had forged deeper into the black, looking for where the enemy had come from rather than where they were going. There were nearly uncountable stars in that general direction, and with warp drives allowing incredible speeds, the Empire could reach out from literally tens of thousands of them. It would be worse, of course, if they had anything remotely close to the transition drive, but even without it, things were going to be difficult enough. "Have we finished calculating the likely origin points?" Morgan asked as he drifted across the bridge and grabbed a hand grip near the navigation station. "Narrowed it down to a likely cone about 50 light-years across, sir," the lieutenant standing station at navigation answered. "With the data we have, I doubt we'll get it any narrower."
50 light-years across, 150 times light-speed cruising speed, Morgan said. "So conservatively, we're looking at maybe a cone 4 light-years deep. How many stars, 150?
A little less.
It's a start. Break them up among the rogues. Start plotting hyperspectral scans and look for any signs of planets and habitation."
"Yes, sir."
He watched the work begin before pushing off from his location and drifting away. The crew would expand the cone outward if nothing showed up in the initial scans. Given what they knew from the Primine, it was unlikely the hyperspectral scans would turn up anything similar to Earth, whose environment was still heavily scarred from wars, pollution, and unregulated population growth. Yet the Primine had signs of habitation that they were unable to fully mask, even given their extreme deference to the natural order of things. Morgan highly doubted that the Empire would be nearly so neat about things.
"We'll find them for you, Admiral," Morgan thought grimly. "I just hope you have a plan for what to do with them when we do."
AEV Bellerophon. The task group exited transition well outside the heliopause of the small Primine colony system, running dark as soon as they secured from transition and immediately turning to circle around the edge of the elliptical plane. On board the Bell, Roberts stood his watch silently as he observed the data coming in across all their passive scanners. Technically, stealth wasn't yet necessary, as the enemy had been observed a week out. Nothing the Imperials had would be able to pick out targets as small as ships at that range, especially not ships that had just literally appeared from nowhere with no real light trace to follow. Still, the moment they had appeared near the system, the task force had begun leaving a light trace that could be tracked. Better to minimize it, just in case. While they were circling the system on warp drive, Roberts turned the bridge over to Commander Little and made his way down to the engineering sections where the chief was working on a little project at his request. "Chief?" Roberts greeted the woman as he walked onto the open deck that was littered with components and automated fabrication systems, as well as people all working furiously. "Give me some news."
"We barely got started, Captain," Chief Winona Criff said, not bothering to look up from the coding she was handling. "Give us a couple of shifts, and maybe I'll have something for you."
"I don't need anything yet, just an idea of whether you can do it."
"Of course I can do it," she grumbled. "I told you I could. But we're going to strip the Bell and Bow of most of our logistical materials. If you scuff the ships up after this, don't come crying to me for repairs."
"Keep enough back to patch a few holes," Roberts countered wryly. "But I'm hoping to avoid any direct fighting this time around."
"Would be nice," Criff said sourly. "We should be able to cover a few light seconds across with what we can build in the next few days. Not much more than that, however. So wherever you're going to put these things, you better be sure the enemy is sailing through."
"I'll handle that side of things," Roberts confirmed. "Just make certain we can recover if needed."
"I'm fully aware of how valuable this kit is, Captain. If the enemy doesn't vape the lot, we'll be able to pick them up."
"All right. I'll leave you to it, then."
She didn't bother to acknowledge him as he left, both amusing and irritating Roberts, but he was used to engineers and their occasional periods of distraction. Buying time. Chapter 12. AEV Odysseus, Rankiel System. Steph glared at Eric through bleary eyes, wondering how the hell the old farty called boss managed to look clean and composed after the previous night. Oh, sure, they hadn't drunk that much. Eric would never actually get drunk while on his own ship. That was just not on. They had been up late, the initial bitching party morphing into reminiscences about old war stories and the like. Morning shift felt like someone had poured sand in Steph's eyes, and while the painkillers had taken care of the headache, he still felt like he was on the wrong side of a 3-day shift. Eric, meanwhile, had been on the bridge when he arrived, despite Steph being almost half an hour early for his shift. Worse, Eric looked like he'd been working furiously for hours, judging from the state of his station, and still looked fresh, as though he'd just waltzed onto the deck. Just not right, that's what it was.
"Steph," Eric called. "We've got a rendezvous with a transport from the Forge in 3 hours. Coordinates are at your station."
"You got it, sir," Steph said as he crossed over immediately. "What are we picking up?"
"Everything they had in stock to make tea cannons," Eric responded, "along with as many laser capacitors as they could spare. I couldn't get any magnetic containment units out of them, but engineering is putting a bunch of bare-bones gravity containment units together, which will double as drive mechanisms." Steph had to blink, trying to process what he'd just heard.
"Excuse me, sir?"
"Your idea, Steph. We're going to give it a shot."
Steph racked his brain, but honestly couldn't think of anything he'd said that might have kicked off this particular ant's nest.
"Idea, sir?"
"Drones, Steph, drones. We're building drones."
"Oh, that idea. Do we have time for that?"
Steph asked, mostly because it seemed more polite than asking his friend and CO if he'd lost his goddamn mind.
"Mostly off-the-shelf parts," Eric replied in what he assumed was supposed to be a reassuring tone. Frankly, Steph felt anything but reassured. Ray's had a way of becoming manic when he snapped his jaws down around a new idea, and this was looking more and more like one of those moments. Steph just hoped this episode wasn't going to come back on them like it had when they went after the Block's submersible carrier. Fighters weren't supposed to engage from below sea level, never mind what tricks they could pull with countermass generators. Steph shuddered.
"Damn it, and I'd managed to suppress those memories. I need more liquor."
"Have you been up all night?" Steph asked suspiciously.
"Working, Steph," Eric responded, not looking up from his station. "We're on a clock."
"Oh, crap. He's definitely in that manic mode again. This is gonna suck."
On the bright side, though, Steph was no longer feeling that impending sense of doom from the approaching Imperial fleet. Of course, it had now been replaced by the impending sense of doom from his own captain. Troublesome though it was, the circumstance was still an improvement. Mila stepped on the deck, and the captain instantly shifted his focus.
"Lieutenant Shans," Eric called. "I have a job for you."
She looked around, suddenly nervous, as the captain's wide-eyed grin settled on her.
"Yes, sir?"
"Poor girl," Steph thought. "She really has no idea what she's about to be immersed in. Welcome to Wild Weston's Flying Circus, Mila. It's about to get hot up in here."
Chief Garrick stared, slack-jawed, at the piles of gear that were being unloaded onto his once pristine deck. Just pallets by the dozen and more of replacement parts for gear that didn't need replacing and could be fabricated on their own if they did.
"Tell me again who signed off on this,"
the chief said quietly to the young lieutenant he was shepherding through the process of managing the logistics side of a Heroic-class vessel's engineering department. The job wasn't as glamorous as maintaining the engines, but was every bit as necessary to the proper running of a warship, though few people seemed to realize it.
"Commodore Weston, chief," the lieutenant said grimly, though completely lacking the deep-seated horror the chief felt at seeing the sheer mess splattered across his deck.
Garrick sighed.
"I suppose that means I don't get to gripe about this shit, then."
"Please, chief," Lieutenant Chin said wearily, "try to keep the swearing down, or at least in my direct company. It's harder to ignore the unmilitary attitude when you're swearing in my face."
"Whoever put that in the books as unmilitary must have been a civilian.
More like an admiral with fuzzy memories of his time in the lower officer ranks," Chin corrected. "But it's still on the books, so if you'd please not test my selective hearing so blatantly, I'd be most appreciative."
"You're not bad for a butter bar, Chin,"
Garrick said, amused, as he grabbed an order sheet on a digital flimsy and looked over the inventory.
"Okay, what do we have here? Over 100 transition wave guides, tachyon reactors, and...
is that 3,000 supercapacitors?"
Looks like, Chin admitted, checking the numbers on his own flimsy. Damn, I didn't know anyone had that many stockpiled. Why aren't they already in a hole? At a guess, I'd say that the Primine ran out of hulls before they ran out of supercapacitors.
Right. Fair point, I guess. Do you have anything on your sheet that says what we're supposed to do with all this junk?
The junk was likely worth a fair chunk of Earth's conventional military forces in terms of pure value. However, as Chin flipped through the reams of data on his sheet, he had to shake his head.
Nothing. No packing orders, no transit number, nothing. We don't even have inventory reference on any of this stuff. Are we supposed to leave it sitting here on the deck?
Hell we are, Garrick said. This junk is not cluttering up my deck if I have anything to say about it. Luckily, Chief,
a new voice startled them into turning around,
you do have something to say about it.
Both Lieutenant and Chief snapped to attention as the Commodore approached them, another young lieutenant walking uncertainly at his side.
Chief, Lieutenant, Weston said, allow me to introduce Mila Shans. She's on loan from the Primine fleet, one of their weapon specialists.
Garrick shifted his attention just slightly to the woman standing at the Commodore's side. She had dark hair and pale skin, which, coupled with her small stature, made her look far younger than she had to be. Normally, Garrick might have written her off for that alone, but there was something about the glittering, shadowy look behind her eyes that spoke of depths, so he withheld his opinion and shifted back to look at the Commodore.
"Begging your pardon, Commodore, sir," he said politely, "but what are we supposed to do with all of this? You're going to build drones for me, Chief."
Chief Garrick thought those were the very last words he'd expected out of the Commodore's mouth at that time. Well, maybe not the very last, but certainly up there.
"Yes, sir,"
he ventured, trying and failing not to sound like he was asking a question. It was the Commodore's grin, he decided. That was what put him off. Creepy. Lieutenant Shans wasn't quite sure what had just happened. If she were to be asked about it, she wasn't certain she could even remember how she got from the bridge to the cargo decks. She remembered the Commodore intercepting her, a rush of motion and information, and the next thing she knew she was standing in the middle of what looked like a logistics depot after a hurricane.
"Sir," she ventured softly, "I'm confused. Why am I here? What is a drone?"
"You're here because this is your job for now," Eric said, still grinning. "You're going to supervise this lot, Lieutenant. Build me drones."
She nodded slowly.
"Very well, but what are drones?"
The two she had just been introduced to stared at her, clearly stunned, but the Commodore just seemed to find it all even more amusing somehow.
"You'll work it out," he assured her. "I've sent the basic requirements to your files. Good luck. You have a week."
When he turned and strode off, Mila actually thought the situation had to be a joke of some sort. Only when he didn't turn back around to tell her as much did she begin to have the sinking sensation that the Commodore was actually serious. She looked around the mess she stood in the middle of, trying to figure out just what it was she was supposed to do.
"What is a drone?" she asked again, trying not to sound plaintive.
"Ma'am? A drone is an unmanned vehicle, either controlled remotely or by AI," the nearby chief stated firmly.
"Is that all?"
Mila frowned, confused.
"Why am I on this task?"
She looked around the parts that lay scattered across the deck, eyes narrowing as she spotted a crewman handling something familiar.
"Crewman, careful with that!"
Mila snapped, her voice suddenly sharp.
"That is not something to trifle with!"
The crewman stared back for a moment before slowly setting the odd sphere back into its case.
"You know what that is, Lieutenant?"
the other lieutenant asked cautiously.
"Of course. It is a space warp amplifier," she answered. "Part of the drive system for a moderate to large shuttle."
Mila sighed.
"Pardon me. I need to determine just what the specifications are that the Commodore has left me with."
She turned and headed for a computer station, leaving the others to stare after her.
"Maybe the Commodore hasn't entirely lost it after all,"
the chief allowed grudgingly before she was entirely out of earshot. Mila ignored the comment. At the computer station, she examined the files that had been left in her folders.
The Commodore had an interesting concept, one that her people had never used so far as she knew, that combined some of the strengths of both Primine and Terran technology in ways that she was unused to seeing.
"The majority of this is straightforward," Mila realized as she looked it over.
The control system would have to be a combined effort, but she was familiar enough with Primine automation systems as well as Terran software now to integrate the code. The hardware was mostly compatible, based around a Primine drive system with a Terran transition cannon as the primary weapon. In many ways, the design the Commodore had thrown together was little more than a flying gun, but that was fine. She could do that. The final piece of the composite, however, was something entirely different.
"The man is insane."
She had, reluctantly, come to some degree of acceptance concerning the Terran fascination with things that could utterly obliterate them from the universe. It was a specific and odd personality quirk for a species to engage in, playing with material that literally only existed to destroy parts of the normal universe. She had not, however, come to internalize said quirk herself. Mila sighed.
"At least he wants to get it off the Odysseus. That much is progress."
"Fine." Mila turned back around, eyes scanning the area again as she strode toward the chief and the lieutenant.
"Chief?"
Mila said.
"Ma'am?"
"I require this deck cleared. Move all material against the walls," she ordered. "Place everything in groups. Call in the full shift. We will require all engineering ratings. No, make that two shifts. Engineering ratings with qualifications in small craft maintenance, transition technology, and..."
Mila shuddered.
"And antimatter production."
Chief Garrick and Lieutenant Chin exchanged startled, extremely concerned glances.
"Ma'am?"
the chief croaked.
"Commodore's orders, chief," Mila said. "I assure you I am no happier with this than you are."
"Small comfort, ma'am."
"Chief, be about your business," Mila said sourly.
"Lieutenant, oversee the inventory and organization of this material, if you please. We will require exact numbers of all parts."
"I'll see to it."
"Good. I have a design to work on."
Mila paused as she started to turn around, an object off in the far corner catching her eye. She smiled as she recognized it.
"I may have an idea for an improvement to the Commodore's design request."
Steph tossed a glance over his shoulder toward the back of the bridge as the Commodore reappeared sans Mila. It wasn't that he was worried exactly, at least not for Mila's safety or anything like that. Her sanity, that was a possible concern. He was, however, burning with curiosity as he watched Eric step back into the command station and return to work as though nothing had just occurred. Eric's acumen for calmly working under almost any pressure was legendary, but there were times when it drove Steph absolutely batty. Steph could just barely remember the suggestion he'd made, something about mounting a T-cannon on a drone to fire pulse torpedoes. Insane, but then they seemed to be living in insane times. His musings were cut short as a new contact appeared on the threat board. Steph tagged it automatically to his station as the scanner station chimed behind him, bringing the contact to the general attention of the bridge.
"Primine cruiser approaching, Commodore," the lieutenant standing watch announced.
"They're expected," Weston said without looking up from his work. "We're going to be putting together a joint task force. Clear them to a 20-kilometer approach. Watch their vectors closely."
"Aye, sir."
A 20-kilometer approach was effectively welcoming the other ship inside the Odysseus's point defense envelope, simultaneously saying that they were trusted as well as protected. Anything less than 10,000 kilometers was ludicrously close, given the nature of their weapons, and under a full light second was knife range. If you were going to be shuttling anybody back and forth, though, closer was still better. Even with countermass technology and the more effective Primine versions, it wasn't considered safe to go popping around at high speed that close to the steep gravity shears of an active core. Steph updated his tag to list the ship as an ally and then largely ignored it, though he did spare a thread of his attention on the approach vectors. He trusted the Primine. They were generally decent, if unimaginative, pilots. But he'd seen what happened to ships that got too close to a cruiser's core. Keeping that from happening to him would always be a priority.
That done, he returned his focus to wondering just what Reyes really thought he was going to be able to pull off with the drone concept. Certainly it would alleviate some of the concerns about using antimatter charges, but Steph didn't think there was remotely enough time to really put something effective together before the weapons would be needed. The numbers approaching them were too stark to be handled with simple tricks.
We need a new AA initiative, Steph thought grimly, because this block ain't going to be turned back by anything less than a clear show of superiority, and we just don't have anything like that.
Eric barely spared any attention for the approaching ship that he knew would be but the first of many. Rael had informed him that the Primine forces were recalling all patrols, and the ships that had been on the lookout for any remnants of the Drossen would be retasked to the more pressing concern. He knew that Admiral Grayson would in turn break loose every ship she could from Earth. There were also a few force multipliers left that he could leverage, especially if he could construct one or two more of his own that no one had seen yet. Steph's offhand comment about drones might be enough to give them a temporary edge, but he had few illusions about its overall effectiveness in the coming battle. That didn't mean he was going to give up any slight edge he could gain himself just then, cost be damned. With everything on the line, he could authorize experiments that would never get through the cost-benefit calculations back home, so while he could, he would draw on everything he possibly had. If any of it turned out to be useful in what was coming, Eric would count that as a win. And if not, well, he wouldn't be around for the bean counter to bitch at. Win-win.
I wish we hadn't been forced to send the others on ahead, Eric thought as his mind turned back to the issue that had kept the Odysseus from deploying with the task group. Odysseus, the boy king.
Perhaps that was a better moniker than the warrior king, Eric now supposed. The alien intelligence was problematic to the proper running of a starship, and yet they had no choice but to fight the ship whether they liked it or not. In peacetime, Eric had no doubt that the Odysseus would have been pulled off the line instantly, sent to some research and development area. The vessel would be maintained only to keep the entity active until the military could figure out what the hell had happened to create it, and whether it was worth creating again or enacting countermeasures. He didn't know which decision made the most sense himself. A self-aware warship was not exactly a comforting thought, particularly one as powerful as the Odysseus. They'd had to do some scrambling to make sure that the weapons on the ship weren't accessible without physical human intervention. Most required a physical circuit to be bridged, a throwback to wet Navy doctrine, and something that wasn't shared by the Primine. Eric had ordered every system to be scrubbed through again just to ensure that no one had missed anything when the hardware breaks had been first installed. A deep-seated paranoia concerning artificial intelligence in Earth culture seemed to ultimately apply here, though Odysseus wasn't precisely what he would call artificial, of course.
Are you sure?
Eric looked up to see the young man in armor and glittering pink makeup staring at him, intense curiosity alight in his expression.
"That you aren't artificial?" Eric asked, receiving a nod in return. "As near as I can be. You're no more artificial than I am, though given what we've learned about human DNA since we encountered the Primine, that isn't as certain a fact as I once believed."
The boy hummed thoughtfully, then abruptly shifted topics.
"Lieutenant Shans has some interesting ideas to complement your and Lieutenant Commander Michaels' concepts," he said, startling Eric briefly.
"Oh?" Eric said.
"Yes. She has already improved your conceptual design in several ways and discovered one of the key flaws."
"Flaws?"
"Communications lag will be an issue on platforms that small," Odysseus said simply, making Eric curse softly.
He really should have remembered that.
FTL transmissions were difficult. There were differing levels of communication possible, primarily through the modulation of FTL tachyons. However, due to the nature of the tachyon pulses, you needed extremely significant power sources and a very concise transmission code. Analog voice and video were possible, but burst code was by far preferred. A drone platform, particularly one that needed every ounce of power for its weapon system, was not going to have a mounted FTL transceiver.
That would mean they'd have to keep the drones close to the ship if they wanted to maintain a real-time weapons control system. But that would undo several of the key advantages of using a drone platform in the first place. Drones were soft targets, so the last thing you wanted was for them to be loitering around close to laser magnets like a heroic-class cruiser. They'd be fried by even a grazing strike from an Imperial laser, and if the Odysseus accidentally dodged an Imperial laser and sucked an antimatter-armed drone into its gravity well... Okay, that's not going to happen.
And did Lieutenant Shans have a solution? He asked mildly.
Odysseus smiled. Think loyal wingman, Commodore.
Huh, Eric said, blinking. I haven't thought about that program in a long time. Not since I was active duty with the U.S. Marines. They killed it when the anti-drone treaty was signed, but it had some promise. Still, where is she going to get... Oh.
He made a quick notation on his station before looking back to Odysseus, noticing that pretty much everyone on the bridge was now paying close attention to his discussion with the boy intelligence.
If you have any more concepts to bring to my attention, please do so, Eric said, his voice clear and carrying.
Of course, Commodore,
Odysseus responded, his tone shifting to a more professional one, in so much as a teenage boy could manage to put on a professional front. Eric smiled at the eager salute, posture so stiff the boy was practically vibrating, and a matching expression on his made-up face.
Head out, he said, nodding to the door, and don't vanish until you're alone, damn it.
Odysseus nodded, dropping the salute and doing an almost textbook heel turn as he marched out to the rear hatch. He was soon out of sight, clearly having read Eric's mental order.
He's an interesting boy, Miriam Heath said as she quietly approached. That makeup is hardly in keeping with military policy, mind you.
Mentally, he seems to be a confused teenager, Eric said, sighing.
Confused? I don't understand.
Gender issues. Eric said as quietly as he could. Odysseus is obviously a male name, and we even call the ship the Warrior King. But what gender do we assign vessels?
Miriam's eyes widened.
A ship is always female.
Exactly. I think he's trying to figure out his gender, and is having some rather serious issues with the concept, Eric said. I've been trying to ignore it, just because it's not really an issue of discipline in this case, and any attention I bring to it will just make the problem worse.
Ugh, Miriam rubbed her temples. I think I just sprained my brain trying to wrap it around the concepts alone.
Tell me about it. Honestly, I'm far from an expert in dealing with the experiences of transgender servicemen and women. Just don't have the know-how needed to put it all in context. So I try and do what I think is fair and hope I'm right. This is worse again, because I have no frame of reference by which I can understand the issues Odysseus is dealing with.
More or less with you there, Miriam sighed.
What can we do?
Just normalize him, Eric said. Treat him normally, as if nothing is out of the ordinary. Let people see you do that. We need the Odysseus, which means we need Odysseus now, as he is the ship, in a very real way. We can't afford any hint of fracture in command or hint of issues with the status of the ship, otherwise people will take that cue from us.
Understood, sir.
Eric hoped that she did, and that everyone took the appropriate cues from his actions. One thing he was certain of was that they could not afford for the crew to start thinking the ship was cursed or haunted. There was too much riding on every single ship Earth and the Primine forces had available for them to sacrifice even one heroic over something as stupid as superstition, even when that superstition was clearly true.
Chapter 13 Station Unity 1, Earth Orbit.
Admiral Grayson sighed deeply, knowing that she couldn't pull this off any further, but hating it all the same as she walked up the ramp into the large Delta Wing shuttle. The hydraulics whined softly behind her as the ramp rose up to the bottom of the lifting body craft. A pressure seal hissed as the ramp closed. She'd managed to avoid returning to Earth since her discussion with Commodore Weston, only getting as close as her office in the high orbital facility that was Unity 1. That had worked so far, but no farther.
She'd been recalled in no uncertain terms to brief various governmental leaders in person. That meant returning to the Earth's magnetic field and, more specifically, bringing her brain into said field. From what Weston and Tanner had told her, whether this Gaia entity chose to reveal itself or not, the moment Grayson was deep enough inside the field, everything she contemplated would become part and parcel of Gaia's memories. The very thought gave her chills. And hives. Lots of hives. Grayson absently scratched at the back of her hand as the shuttle finished its checklist and received clearance to depart. The rumble of the twin turbine reactors powering up sent shivers through the shuttle. Normally it was a sound, a feeling of power that she had some appreciation for. This time, however, she would have preferred to remain behind on the nearly silent decks of the space station. Duty, however, called. There was no window for her to admire the view as the shuttle powered out into space from the station, but she'd spent enough hours staring at the unparalleled vista available from her office to have the image permanently etched in her mind. The shuttle spiraled around the station, locked in a flight control pattern as they waited for their window to make re-entry. Since they had priority with the control network, the shuttle soon began its descent. Grayson felt the first slight buffets of atmospheric turbulence through the seat she was strapped into. It was, to her mind, a point of no return. She was deep enough within the magnetic field of the planet that Gaia had to have read her. "I wonder how long it will be before she makes her appearance," Grayson wondered. "Quickly, or will it bide its time? Why wait?" Grayson tried not to jump, and the straps holding her down kept her in her seat at least, but she felt like her body had just attempted to make an orbital burn all on its own. As her heart raced, she twisted in her seat to see that her once empty compartment was now home to another passenger. The woman, or rather female-formed entity, that was sitting there with a beatific smile on her face, just looked back with no reaction to Grayson's glare. Gaia, if anything, seemed far calmer than Weston's descriptions had painted her. She appeared as a tall woman, over 6 feet, with thick and wild hair that almost seemed to have a life of its own. Smooth, dark skin offered features that stood out all the more as she smiled, her teeth almost a blinding white.
"I was rather put out at the time, my dear Captain. Well, Commodore now, I suppose," the woman mused. "Where was I? Oh, yes. I was rather put out at the time I met with him. Those things were quite distasteful. I really have no way to describe them that you might understand. They were like mental parasites, perhaps, scratching at my brain." Gaia shrugged casually. "Without them, and with the whole world's focus now beyond the edge of the atmosphere, beyond the stellar envelope itself, well, I've been feeling rather cheerful and optimistic lately. It's almost similar to how you humans feel when smoking marijuana, or when you're deep in fantasy, I suppose."
Grayson's eyes widened at that statement, not remotely sure how to process the thought or if she should even try. She elected to change the subject.
"Weston and Tanner suggested that you would probably make yourself known." "Of course they did," Gaia smiled. "You'd be surprised how much I, and I suspect the one known as Central, actually make ourselves known. During the invasion, I whispered advice in many ears, Admiral, and I have walked softly among you for millennia. However, you are fully aware of me, and you hold a fascinating bit of information, one I could hardly resist, if I were to be honest. Odysseus, truly fascinating."
"It's messing with a warship we can hardly afford to have running at less than optimum efficiency," Grayson scowled. "Fascinating might be accurate in peacetime, but this is anything but. According to Tanner, Central has never encountered anything like this. I don't suppose you might have better answers?" Gaia was silent for a moment.
"Answers? No, those I do not have, Admiral. Ideas, thoughts, suspicions, those I have aplenty."
Grayson waited a few beats before growing frustrated. "I don't suppose you care to share?" Gaia smiled slightly, shaking her head.
"Not at this time. Good voyages, Admiral. I will, as you say, be in touch."
Grayson blinked, and the seat beside her was again empty,
leaving her to wonder just how she was supposed to deal with the universe from a position that held any remote connection to rationality. The whole damned universe had gone mad since that day she'd seen Eric Westenhoff in the Odyssey on her maiden voyage. The garden was one of the most perfect places on Earth, and possibly in the entire galaxy, to Gaia's thoughts at least. Certainly she hadn't seen anything remotely close to it in the memories of her children, who had traveled far and returned. She walked barefoot across the ground cover, a thick, luxurious moss that was deep green and cool to the touch. Her sheer gown, an affectation of human fashion that would have appeared at home in an artist's rendition of a dream or fantasy sequence, flowed with each step. Above her, the stars beamed down, shimmering through the atmosphere as she paused near a large central tree. Gaia reached out to press her hand into the rough bark, considering what she had learned. Odysseus was a puzzle, but she did have her suspicions. During the last battle of the invasion, she had quickly entered the ship as it passed, briefly encountering the minds of the crew and more. She remembered looking deep into the singularity, a point of infinite blackness, and being shocked when, for a split second, she saw something other than infinity. It was like a reflection, though not precisely. Again, she found herself unable to describe the scenario. Something seemed entirely off, above all, and she had no frame of reference even in her own mind. It was just experience. No one had ever experienced anything like this, not ever in all of Earth's history, and possibly never in the history of time itself. No words could exist to describe it, and yet she longed for one, just one word that fit. Gaia never would have believed that she could be so tied to language, and yet there it was. For all her mental acuity, infinite memory, and transcendental experiences, by human standards, she craved a word. Ultimately, she would have to endure without it for the moment.
"Humans, such interesting beings, are they not, my dear?"
The sudden voice caused Gaia to pivot slightly as a large blonde figure appeared some distance behind her. Power emanated from him in tangible ways, but he seemed largely indifferent in tone and attitude.
"Saul," she said with a slightly annoyed tone, "what brings you here?"
"Merely this new development," Saul told her. "I don't believe I've ever had something with this level of fascination happen. Literally, ever. It's all rather amusing."
Gaia rolled her eyes.
"You find everything amusing."
"And nothing," the big man agreed affably. "Should I care about them, really?"
"What are we without them? Their thoughts are our thoughts," Gaia challenged. "I remember the early days, the bestial urges that those such as we could never fulfill, the frustrations of it all, in the lack of understanding or logic."
"You believe your memory is somehow superior to mine?" Saul snorted. "Gaia, you are too soft on them."
Wind rustled around her as she turned to face off, her hair flowing as her eyes blazed.
"I am the gentle mother and the vengeful bitch," she snarled. "But that does not mean I must be cold and uncaring. I am not you, Saul."
"Give it time," he told her, unimpressed by the display she'd just created. "You'll come around, eventually."
"We are the same age of mind, Saul," Gaia snapped. "Stop acting as though you're my father or some idiot older sibling."
"I am older than you can imagine."
"And yet you're still a 13-year-old child, petulantly pretending greatness as your own, when it has been inherited from others at best, or is a mere reflection of others at worst. Go, leave my garden, Saul."
The big man pulled himself up to his full height, power rolling off him in waves.
"You believe that they are somehow special. They believe that they are special. I see them for what they are. Merely another insignificant species in a long line of insignificant species. Open your eyes, Gaia. They are nothing to us. Nothing to you. They are arrogant enough to believe they can hide their thoughts from us by staying away."
"And are they not right?" Gaia asked with a soft smile. "The only mistake they made is in the range, and if someone told them about you, they would correct that mistake promptly.
Saul drew back. You would not dare.
Wouldn't I? Begone, Saul. We will have words another time, when you are more inclined to civility.
Saul glowered at her for a time before he finally vanished, leaving Gaia alone in her garden, aside from a scorched spot where the other had been standing. She sighed and waved her hand, causing the ground to writhe with green as moss grew back, leaving the garden unmarred once more. There was a great deal to think on, and decisions to be made.
AEV Enterprise, Sol System.
All systems secured, Commander Bride reported. Word from the COB is that all new munitions and equipment have been loaded, stored, and secured, sir.
That's good news, Commander, James said.
Contact Unity and clear us for departure, then get a course for the heliopause. We'll transition directly to Rankeel as soon as we're outside the solar influence.
Aye, Skipper, Bride said before heading off to issue the orders.
James noted his departure in a vague sort of way, but was more intent on studying the likely composition of enemy forces. The Empire seemed to prefer a fleet of heavy combat vessels rather than the mix of light and medium ships that had been the standard for Earth's Blue Navy, even through the Block War. Their version of heavy was so damned heavy that they could absorb insane levels of fighting before being destroyed. That put a carrier platform like the Enterprise in an odd situation. Normally, the ability to project force through her fighters was a game-changing factor in a conflict. The small Vorpals he commanded could flit in and out of an area, all but invisible to anything but an accidental direct scan in the deep black, while packing as much power as one could expect from a formidable task force. The problem was that the enemy ships could easily stand off a not insignificant task force and remain operable afterward.
How the hell can my fighters take on something that can just absorb that kind of firepower? Don't these damn things have any weak points?
That seemed to be the overall problem from what he could see. While they likely did have weak spots, they seemed to be buried deep inside dozens of meters of armor and deck after deck of non-essential sections. It was good military design and good space design, and was a pain in the ass for him to game as the op force. He was sourly aware that the enemy was just as likely having similar issues trying to figure out how to crack the heroics, but he wasn't in command of a heroic. His command was a flying eggshell that carried even more fragile flying eggshells. They all packed a rather large number of hammers to throw at the enemy, but they wouldn't do much good if they were cracked before they got a chance to unload them. He had no doubt that every captain in the Black Navy, along with a large number of mines and other services, were currently struggling with the very same problems. They were in a time crunch, and that meant that everyone was going to be throwing whatever they could find at the wall and hoping to hell some of it would stick.
I hope the Admiral has a real solution up his sleeve. But in the meantime,
James frowned, looking at the munitions list they'd loaded onto the Big E in the last few days, noticing the large shipments intended for the Vorpal squadrons.
Commander, you have the bridge, he said, standing up. I'll be in main engineering, speaking with Chief Yu.
Aye, Captain, I have the bridge,
Bride said automatically as James cleared his station and stepped away. Bride took his place, and James started making his way down through the decks to main engineering. Chief Yu was one of the many block specialists for the Alcubierre warp drive that all Earthships had been fitted with, including the Enterprise. The Confederation and its allies had significant experience in tachyon transition drives, which, while terrifying, were far faster, but the block scientists were the acknowledged experts in warp drives. James had done his research, which he tried to do for most of the critical systems that his ship relied on, to avoid getting lost when the tech geeks started talking. He took the lift straight down to the engineering decks, feeling gravity lessen as the lift slowed its spin to match microgravity conditions. When the lift stopped, James kicked out and drifted onto the deck, keeping to the walls and as out of the way as he could.
Petty officer, he flagged down a woman who was sailing past. Point me to Chief Yu.
Down that way, Skipper,
she said, gesturing behind her as she floated by, not offering up a salute. He didn't blink, just kicked off in the opposite direction. Salutes and other protocol were generally suspended in microgravity.
Just figuring out what direction was up could take a group of people an absolutely stupid amount of time. He sailed into the countermass control section of the ship, taking care not to make contact with anything or anyone. He was probably being paranoid, James knew, since few designs were so crappy as to leave anything overly critical exposed that could be fouled up by a single accident. But there were enough nasty things on a vessel the size of the Enterprise that he would rather not tempt fate. "Chief," he called out, grabbing a hand grip as he slid past, arresting